Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the RC Report. I am your host, RC Carlton. Before we start the program, I want to encourage you to support all things IB. There's our website, iconoclastically bombastic. You can also go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/IBN. Also go to Twitter at OConnellBomb. Today I have a very special guest. She is a TV critic for Variety Magazine. She's a personal hero of mine and inspiration to many, including myself. Welcome to the RC Report, Maureen. How are you? Can I call you Mo?
You can please call me Mo. That'd be great.
Yes. First of all, I don't think we get this a lot from you because you're always talking about other subjects, but I wanted to know how you got to be Maureen Ryan, the TV critic.
Well, that's a good question. I didn't actually go to journalism school like when I was in college. I studied English psychology. I guess I was always interested in people's, you know, human psychology. But I ended up going into book publishing, and then I actually segued into going to journalism school a few years later when I was in my 20s because I realized that I enjoyed the kind of writing that is basically nonfiction. So I wanted to get into that field, so I went to journalism school to get my master's, and then I got some jobs working at a public policy magazine and then a consumer entertainment magazine. So I did a lot of freelancing around that time as well for different publications, music reviews, film reviews, feature stories, that kind of thing. So that was really, I guess that was like the mid-90s or so, late 90s. And then over time, I got to know some people who worked at the Chicago Tribune, and they started to use me as a freelancer for music reviews mostly. And then they needed someone to fill a staff position as one of their editors, so I went over to the Chicago Tribune in, I believe it was 97. And that was really a great education for me. You know, I did a lot of different things there. I was an arts editor for different sections. I wrote some features and some reviews and stories and that kind of thing, some news. So it was really an awesome education. And eventually, you know, I guess about 5 or 6 years into my time at the Tribune, the TV critic went on leave for a year because he had his wife actually got a fellowship somewhere, so they took off for a year. And so during that time, they needed someone to fill in as a TV critic. And myself and another critic kind of filled in. We both did it halftime. And then when the TV critic came back, that he actually didn't really want to do the job anymore. So that was actually, you know, a good thing for me. So hopefully I'm not making this too long. But eventually I became the Chicago Tribune's TV critic. And then I moved on several years later to the Huffington Post, where I was a TV critic. And about 8 months ago, I moved over to Variety, which is where I am the TV critic now, and I'm very happy to get to do what I do. It's a really fun job.
No, it was a good story. It was informative because I don't think I've heard bits and pieces of it, like in your podcast, but I don't think I'd ever heard the whole linear story. Mo, we have right now, a lot of people call it the golden age of television. It's definitely grown by leaps and bounds over the last 10, 15 years. You could all talk about how the prestige drama is in vogue now. But basically, whatever you want to call it, how did we get here where TV is such a huge thing now with over 500 scripted dramas, I believe, last year?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, essentially, you know, media companies are in the business of making money. You know, they always want to make money some way or other. And they found that they could make a lot of money in the sort of like the golden age explosion of, say, I don't know, like 1999 onward. These media companies found that, you know, a cable network that has subscribers paying to subscribe, and they're getting basically the network is getting a fee from the number of people who get that channel. Even if it's a small fee, you know, millions of those small fees add up to a lot of money. So that made them somewhat less dependent on advertisers. Of course, they were also getting that advertising revenue, which made for a great, healthy revenue stream, especially if you had a hit show on cable or broadcast. But essentially, they wanted to start covering all their bets and have networks and shows in all those different arenas. And so it really became a situation where TV could become more adventurous and less shackled to the conventions of the broadcast networks, which churned out a lot of good shows for many years and a lot of terrible ones. But, you know, basically they were limited in terms of what kinds of topics they could take on or what kind of, you know, characters they could tell stories about, because advertisers would object otherwise. There was less of that kind of objection on cable. There was less of that kind of regulation. And certainly with HBO and Showtime and Starz, there were basically no regulations because, you know, basically, and to be honest, there weren't a ton with cable either, but people chose to abide by certain restrictions on content. But with something like HBO or Showtime, you didn't have to abide by any restrictions. You could show anything you wanted and have any kind of story you wanted. So basically, it started exploding because people became more and more into these stories and more intrigued by the kind of characters that we were getting to see. And so now we're actually within another big explosion, which is essentially, the short version of it is that Silicon Valley cash is now flooding the zone in Hollywood, because Netflix has almost, it appears to me, to be a magical checkbook that is unlimited. And I wish I had a magical checkbook, but I don't.
It would be nice, right?
It would be so nice. But they're basically going around town, and now they're the first stop for many people because they're giving people essentially a blank check to make a show, which is a huge thing. And people aren't necessarily going to HBO. They aren't necessarily going to the usual suspects that usually got the top talent in the past. So it's changed, you know, just as there were an array of cable networks that changed the game in sort of like, you know, 2000 to 2010, now the streaming of it all is changing the game again. And I think that there's now, there's actually been, you know, we talk a lot about drama, but there's been a stealth explosion in comedy. And the stats that I was able to pull together with the help of the people who do the research at FX Networks, it's interesting that there's actually been a bigger explosion in comedy because half hours cost even less. You know, the half hour of Broad City, I can guarantee you, costs a lot less than, say, you know, Mr. Robot or The Walking Dead. It costs less to make that half hour show like Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt than it does to make an hour long show like Game of Thrones. So we're seeing a huge explosion in the number of shows and forms and kinds of storytelling and kinds of creators, which for me is really great. And I hope, you know, it seems to me that people are generally liking that, although it's a lot to keep up with. But I think one of the biggest and most truthful things that you could say about TV for a very long time was it was very limited in terms of who got to make shows and who those shows could be about. And that can become really kind of numbing and repetitive over time. So I'm really glad that now we're having all kinds of explosions of who gets to make what and what it gets to be about.
Two-part question. How, because you touched on Netflix, but how have binge-watching and social media changed the way we view television?
That's a great question. I see networks all the time talking about social media in their stats or their press releases and stuff. And I don't know that you can necessarily make a correlation between, social media interests and a show being successful. But I think the ultimate thing that you can say about that, or one of the things you can say about it, is it certainly doesn't hurt, right? You know, I mean, if Scandal, I remember when Scandal first came out, and it was not the show that it is now. It was much more of a case of the week, and it was the rest of the characters who were not Olivia Pope were much less interesting than they became over time. The pace of the show was not as interesting. It was just a little bit more traditional, and I think that the more the show went kind of into this gonzo style that it adopted, and this really fast-paced storytelling style, that was, I don't think that they did it because that's the pace of Twitter, but I think Twitter picked up on that. And really the cast and the creator adopting social media and live tweeting and doing all these things to kind of create or sustain interest in the show was partially because they just didn't have a ton of other options. You know, it was just, to some degree, it was a case of, well, let's try this, and it can't hurt. And I think that that approach is really smart because I really think, you know, anecdotally, and I could be wrong, but I think that there are cases of marginal shows getting a boost through social media and getting a higher profile. Like, I think about the first season of Orphan Black, and that was a show that was on nobody's radar. And even if, say, like, let's say Orphan Black came out 6 years ago, I don't think that you would have seen the explosion of interest that you did in seeing those people in magazine pieces, in all kinds of coverage, in all kinds of, you know, incredible attention, especially to Tatiana Maslany, you know, rightfully attention, getting that attention because she's amazing.
Yeah.
But I think that things like Twitter, Facebook, social media, Instagram, that really drove people's ability to engage with the actors, with the show, and to tell people about it. Word of mouth is really, really important. When you're in a universe of more than 400 scripted primetime shows, you have to use every tool at your disposal. And it's not that it's a silver bullet and it will work for every show, but it absolutely can't hurt for your show to have
It's kind of like a megaphone, like what I'm hearing you saying is that social media kind of serves as a megaphone, because that's how I find out about Earth, Orphan Black, through social media, and you have these people that are just championing these shows, and they might not be that many people that actually watch the show, but the fervorance of the audience kind of helps the show in a way.
Absolutely. No, I totally agree. You know, I've been around the block a few times, and I think that there are shows now that, like, fan campaigns can help a show get on people's radar, and I'm the same way as you. You know, if something has not crossed my radar, or if I've not been able to get to something, you know, not been able to review it or write about it, but a bunch of people on Twitter, they could be total strangers to me in person.
Yeah, it's almost like peer pressure. If you hear enough about it, like,
right.
It makes you check it out because, like, okay, it must be half decent, maybe.
Yeah, you don't want to be behind. You don't want to be left out of the conversation. And also, there are people who I've known on social media, sort of known in quote marks. I mean, I've never met them in real life, but like they seem to be smart. Whether it's other critics or just folks that I've seen around on social media that I've interacted with on Twitter or whatever, if they say, you know what, based on things that you tend to like, I think you would like this show, and enough people say that enough times, that's absolutely going to change my position, and I'm going to hopefully try to catch up with that show.
I want to move on to women and diversity in television. I think for you, from a personal perspective, I think you have personally taught me a lot as a man. I think you can always have so many blind spots where this comes. You say, oh, of course, you know, a man should, you know, you assume that the default position is, and I'm African American, so I tell people when I have racial discussions, like, you're the default position, so you don't get it. You assume that the default position is the right position. But my long-winded way of saying this is that you've gotten me to open my eyes to it, and in my writing too, but you've gotten me to open my eyes to it and see much more than I did before. So in light of that, and in light of the controversy with the Oscars and things like that, what is the state of television as far as diversity? And it's kind of a separate issue, hard to pull away. Diversity in women, like where are we with that on television?
Yeah, you know, and I should rush to add that, you know, I have blind spots too. And I think one of the great things about the pace of social media, and sometimes people are down on it because sometimes it can be unpleasant or, you know, there can be a bad vibe to it, but I would say I'm very pro social media, and I'm pro connecting in that way, because I think that I've learned so much, and fans are always teaching me things, and folks that I interact with on Twitter are always teaching me things. So, you know, for me, it's just an ongoing journey, and I certainly hope that I'm, you know, always learning and always thinking about this stuff, because I'm sure that there are people that I've, you know, offended, or I've had a blind spot that they've, you know, felt like I needed an education on certain points. And we all do, right? Like, that's just the state of us as human beings. We can always learn. So I think, I guess, you know, if I want to be charitable to Hollywood, I would say that it's in a learning mode. But if there's one thing that I don't want Hollywood to do, it's to become complacent and to say, well, we're having a big discussion about race. Okay, well, that's fine. Give people jobs. You know, the discussion part of it becomes very self-serving very quickly, I find, that, you know, when they're asked at a press conference or in an interview or in any kind of format, well, my intention was never to do X or Y, or my intention was never to exclude, or my intention was never to have bias. Well, okay, that's fine. But we're not interested in the intention is, you can only examine that for so long before you need to change your actions and how you conduct yourself. And I think that that's where this, sometimes it's a hidden resistance and sometimes it's an overt resistance. And I just think that there's a very, very much an entitlement philosophy in Hollywood, which is that, well, everyone has to work hard to get here. And so the white men who have these very strong informal and formal networks of support and promotion for their careers they're not about to step aside and give that up or give up some of their social capital or, so to speak, political capital for someone who is not in their networks and in their friendships groups. And
yeah.
So it's a very tough nut to crack because I think that there's just Hollywood is a town that's based, it's run on fear. And so everyone's operating out of fear a lot because they want to be able to get their next job and they don't want to make anyone mad who could interfere with their next job. So, you know, basically there has been some movement on this, but I think that the movement, the pace of it is far too slow and it's far too self-congratulatory for very, very small amounts of progress. And I don't think people are happy with that state of progress, and I don't think they should be happy with it, because the speed with which people will go from making some small step toward progress and patting themselves on the back is blinding sometimes. It's like, no, you're not doing a great thing. You are correcting a wrong. And I think that that's something that, you know, that mentality can be tough to cut through. So, you know, someone who follows statistics on writers' rooms and on directing and other there are other stats out there as well, other bodies that monitor these things. Consistently, year after year, more than 75% of the creators or executive producers of TV shows are white men. And white men form less than 30% of the American population. So it's almost a complete flip, you know, it's almost a complete inverse into how the world is actually when we go out and about and live our lives, you know. So everyone wants to point the finger to everyone else and say that, well, I don't have a bad intent and I don't do this. But I think I'm at the stage of thinking of this, and I'll just sort of say this as my thought on the subject as it is currently in Hollywood. I think there are a lot of people who think that if they are passive and neutral, that they're not doing anything wrong. If they're just simply allowing the systems to operate as they have always operated and passively going along with the flow, then they're not doing any harm. I don't think that's actually the case. I think that these systems of power are so entrenched and so difficult to overcome that I don't think that there's anything such as neutrality. You are either helping in some way, even if it's a small way. You know, if you're the most junior staff writer on a TV show, I am not saying you should be the one with all the weight on you to change the system. But the people who are studio executives, the people who are network executives, the people who are showrunners, they should absolutely be doing more, every single person along that chain. And I think that the systems that they have in place to make these situations better aren't enough, because the numbers don't shift that much every year.
When you watch a show, and we'll stick to the women, when you watch a show, what does, and I don't even like the term, but it's a term that's easiest to use, what does a strong female character look like, or a multifaceted or three-dimensional? Like, what do you think are the hallmarks of that through your observation and years of watching television?
I think that, you know, what I would like out of a female character is that she is as multidimensional as anyone else in that show. You know, that she, that like, one test that I use when I'm writing about a show is, if you're wondering or confused about who the show is about, well, whose goals do we know about? What does each person want in this narrative? You know, there are, even if there are sort of like 10 characters on the show or two or one, the person that the show is about is the person whose goals we understand and have had explained to us. So I certainly know what Jessica Jones wants in that show, you know what I mean? And I think one of the reasons I really like that show a lot is because she wasn't strong all the time. Sometimes she was weak. Sometimes she was not a good friend. Sometimes she was a good friend. Sometimes she was using her powers for good. Sometimes she was more selfish and short-sighted. And so I think, to me, I just look for a character who I want to follow for whatever reason. I don't have to even like them necessarily. You know, I don't sit there and look at every male or female character on the screen and go, wow, I really think this person's a great person and they should get the Nobel Peace Prize for being awesome. You know, I certainly didn't think that about Walter White. I certainly look at the characters, the women on the TV show Unreal, and I don't sit there and go, boy, I want to be just like them. You know,
Do you think there's a hesitation? Do you think there's a hesitation with writing, or maybe it's just a lack of complexity? Do you think there's a hesitation to present, like females as anti-heroes, or risk having females being just labeled, female characters labeled a bitch and unlikable, whereas with the men, we're willing to say, oh, gosh, I love Walter White, I love Tony Soprano, even though they do awful things. Like, do you think there's a hesitancy to that? I mean, there's a double standard in society with that anyway.
Yeah, you've hit the nail on the head. There's definitely a hesitancy, and I think that there have been great complex female characters, you know, like Laura Roslin from Battlestar Galactica, fantastic character played by an amazing actress, written by a writing staff of men and women. So, you know, like, this is absolutely possible. But I think that there is, on the one hand, here's what I think. I don't think people always write what they know, because otherwise how do we get shows about spaceships and dragons and, you know, crazy, you know, imaginative worlds that I could never have thought of. But people write what they're interested in, you know, and I think that, you know, you look at some shows and you can tell what are they interested in. And I think that Lost was really interested in John Locke. Lost was interested in Jack. Lost was interested in Ben Linus. I think if you can look at the final season of Lost and tell me that it was interested in the interior and exterior journey of Kate, I can't accept that argument. I don't think the show is interested in her. And that's fine. I mean, it doesn't have to be interested in every character. But that, to me, is the case of a show where the show started out as a multicultural ensemble with people of all races and colors. And then in the last season, it was mainly about the arc of these epic stories being told about three particular heterosexual white guys. And again, I actually found parts of those stories incredibly moving and great and wonderful. I'm not saying that those stories shouldn't be in the culture, but the part one of it is the hesitancy and just being interested in female characters. But part two of it is, if 80% of the writers are male and 90% of the writers are white, are they going to sit there and the first thing that they do when their pen hits the page or when they begin writing on their laptop, is it going to be a black man? Is it going to be a white woman? Is it going to be a black woman? I mean, I think one of the biggest erasures that I see on TV is women of color. And I think that's directly proportional to how many women of color are showrunners. I mean, I look at something like Fresh Off the Boat, and Nanochka Khan is not a Taiwanese-American woman. She's actually a Persian-American woman. But I think that she has similar experiences that she's able to bring to bear. And I think that informs that show in a way that a lot of sitcoms don't have that level of complexity with their female characters. And I think, you know, how many other mainstream broadcast network shows can you point to that the unequivocal star in the center of the narrative is a woman of color? There's Scandal, and there's Fresh Off the Boat.
Shonda Rhimes shows.
Yeah, and there's Quantico. I mean, there's a few. I'm not saying that they don't exist.
The murder show that she has.
Yeah, How to Get Away with Murder.
They come for one person. Half of them come for one person.
And you know what? But the sad thing about those shows is that they're not successful, right? I mean, I'm joking, obviously. But you look at the thing that's great about the success of Empire is that, and I don't know if I don't want to speak for you, but so often when you would see a black character, that would be one black character in relation to a whole cast that was white. Empire flips the script completely. And it's a bunch of African-American characters, and there's one token white lady, which to me is a more interesting story.
I'm almost searching for a white person sometimes. I feel like you need to have a couple more white people. But it is more interesting.
Exactly.
And I know a lot of my white friends watch it. A lot of my white friends watch it, and I'm always like surprised. Like, I'm almost surprised, but I feel like if there's quality that's presented, I don't think people care. I think
exactly. And I think, you know what?
Gunshot.
Yeah, I mean, I've talked to Kenya Barris about this. He's the creator of Black-ish. And it's so true what he said about, like, the more specific your show is, the more specific the experiences of the character, it actually becomes universal. I mean, I think we've all watched that show that was so bland and so not textured and not deep that those people could have been anyone, and the show just felt like the least common denominator of a bunch of different characters we've seen before. Whereas, you know, people say that they stop Kenya in airports and going, oh, you know, Dre is really afraid of, like, break-ins at his house, and my dad was totally like that, and so this person at the airport will be stopping Kenya to tell him how Dre is just like their dad, but their dad is a white guy. But there's a resonance there when the people and the situations feel really specific and not just generic. Do you know what I mean? And I think that that's what connects with people, one of the things.
What are some, this is like my last question, maybe I can squeeze one more in if you answer
of
really
course.
Quickly. What are some of the under-the-radar shows that are just kind of off the map that maybe the Twitter sphere might be watching, but the general public is not that aware of these shows? What are some good shows you can recommend to people that are under the radar?
Well, you know, one, I don't know if this is a Twitter sphere show or not, but one that's coming back on Netflix pretty soon is called Peaky Blinders. There's actually a couple, there's a few shows coming over from England on Netflix that I think are really good. Peaky Blinders is great. It's about these, it's kind of like turn of the century, or I guess it's the 1920s, gangsters in England, and it's really sort of a rock and roll, really smartly made show about that kind of thing. Another show is Happy Valley, which is about this woman who's a cop in the north of England, and she's really fantastic actress. And what I like about those shows sometimes is that they're only 6 or 8 episodes in a season, so you're not committing to like 22 of something. Another one coming up, these are certainly critically embraced shows, but the big ones coming back for me this summer are, you know, BoJack Horseman is coming back, and but the big ones are Unreal and Mr. Robot, which are
really
great. You know, one other one I want to throw out there before we stop talking, because I could do this all day. I have too many shows that I love. But if people have Amazon Prime, you know, do yourself a favor and get over there and watch the show called Catastrophe. And that show is the ultimate, you know, show that leaves you wanting more, because it's 6 episodes per season. They're under half an hour each. They're very fast-paced, very funny, very well-acted. So you can sit there and literally for, like, you know, shorter than the running time of one Lord of the Rings movie, you can be done with a whole season of Catastrophe. So it's the ultimate case of I wish I wasn't allowed to binge it, because I just, like, will watch them all in one day and then be sad that it's over. But that's, you know, Amazon stuff, I think, is a little bit more under the radar at this point, but that's my favorite show that they've done, I think.
You didn't mention Jane. Your mindset seems to be on the show that about to come, but you didn't mention Jane the Virgin. Pimp that out.
How did
really
I not
quickly.
Mention that? This is something
I know
you mentioned.
One of your
maybe I feel like I'm too much of a stan for Jane the Virgin, but I totally, totally think that people should get over to Netflix and see the first season. I don't know how you would obtain the second season, probably iTunes or what have you, or you might have to wait a few months before second season hits Netflix. But I totally love the show, and I don't know about you, but, like, there are very few shows that I can say that every single week that it's my happy place, but I don't think that I've ever watched an episode of the show and not felt like my mood lifted by it. So that's 100% recommendation for that, for sure.
And what have you thought of Game of Thrones this season?
I think it's been interesting. I really do. I don't love the Ramsay stuff. I think that's the weakest part of it, but I don't know. I mean, tell me what you think, because I think that the show has been, I think quite rightly, it's had problems with how it depicted women, and I think for some of the reasons that we talked about earlier. But I think to me it seems like this season is a lot of the female characters learning from their experiences and taking control and going on the offensive, and I kind of like that, you know, that they're they're not perfect
Sansa,
people.
Yeah, they're definitely Sansa.
They're not
a good example.
Like ideal women, but they're trying to really showcase a different side of how all that works.
Yeah, I think they definitely have done the girl power thing. I think it went too far with Dorne, but I've always felt Dorne was a little goofy with his hand snakes, but
it was really
like
undersold. And I got to tell you, as an old school genre fan, like, I really loved Alexander Siddig, who was cast as one of the main Dorn people, because
I
loved Star Trek Deep Space Nine, which is my favorite Trek series. And so I was super psyched that he was going to turn up and be on the show and play this powerful guy. And then, is it just me, or do they sometimes cast people and then they get like four scenes and they don't really matter? You know what
I'm
saying?
Yeah, kind of like that. I remember the girl that was with the White Walker. No, she wasn't with the White Walker. She's a wildling, and it was the big episode where John fought the big blue White Walker guy.
Oh, yeah,
and she, and she had like lines, and she was like part of the show, and then she died. I'm like, okay, let's get invested
in
her for no
reason. But hey, Ramsey's still around, and he's super boring.
Yeah, Ramsey's definitely still around.
Come on.
Ramsey's actually growing on me, sadly. I don't know why. He hasn't meant much to me, but he's growing on me. But with Game of Thrones, for me, there's so many characters. There's just, like, storylines I'm not invested in. So I'm not invested in Bran, but I'm invested in Jon. And I'm invested in Sans. I'm invested in Arya. So I think everyone picked what they're invested in and what they're not, because there's so many characters.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that, you know, that's one of the problems with the show, is that it almost spoils you for choice. It's kind of like going to a buffet, and you're like, oh, my God, there's so many good dishes, but I want more of this one and more of this one.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
But then that dish runs out too
fast. Yeah, exactly. Yep, yeah. The only problem I have, the biggest problem I have, is I wish Arya, the Mr. Miyagi stuff, that just reminds me of Karate Kid. I need that.
Yeah.
I need that to speed up a little bit. I need her.
Really. Get out there and start doing some, like, serious kung fu vengeance, you know?
Exactly. Well, Mo, thank you so much. This has been a pleasure. It's been an honor. You do inspire me. You're one of my heroes. You even taught me that a woman can be my hero, and that's okay.
That's awesome. That's so kind of you to say that. It's really kind.
It really is the truth. That's in my heart, and I really appreciate you coming on. And I'll be reading your stuff.
Well, thanks so much. I can't wait to put this podcast out there and tell folks about it. I'm really excited to be able to do it.
Thank you again, Mo. I appreciate it.
All right. Have a great weekend.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was Maureen Ryan, my favorite, and for my money, screw Steppenwolf, my money, the best critic on the internet and in America. Again, if you enjoyed this podcast, you can support the page. I gave you the information at the beginning, but also you can go to iTunes, search IBN, preferably give me a 5-star rating, and give us a review if you have the time to do so. You can do the same thing. Do the method that Google Play Music has. Also search IBN. Until next time, this has been RC. Hope you guys have a great Memorial Day weekend.